Okay, welcome everyone. If I could have everyone's attention. We are beginning this evening Perek Yud Aleph, which is not only a new chapter, but it's also a new story. And as you may recall, the opening psukim of Perek Yud Aleph are basically the last story of Parshas Noach, even though the Parsha doesn't end immediately, and is a very, very famous and a very consequential and a very fascinating story, and that is the story of the Migdal Bavel, the great, great tower. I was remembering, in fact, I pulled out off the shelf just an hour ago or so, the fact that, I don't know if it's his most recent, because he's a prolific author, but if not the most, then a recent book by the British Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, called The Dignity of Difference, which is actually a very controversial book at the time. Not everyone liked it. But anyway, the cover photo, or the cover, it's a picture, it's a drawing. The cover drawing on his book is Migdal Bavel. And it's all about, you know, he's talking about the post-Bavel world. In terms of all the differences in the world that happen in the aftermath, you know, how we all can get along kind of thing. I was just quickly flipping through it to see if there was anything that caught my eye right in the beginning that I could use for the shiur. There wasn't. But maybe, apparently it's a leitmotif of the whole book. And I just give that as an example of how consequential the story is. In other words, for example, you know, whether it's the story with Noah or other things that we see, we believe they're fascinating. We believe they have objective and ultimate value. They are in the Chumash and we can learn lessons from them. But it's not, there isn't obvious or tangible ramifications of the story necessarily. There are some. I mean, the fact that we exist is because Noah got saved in the ark and that kind of thing. But here you have something a little bit more immediate and certainly consequential to this very day. Right? The fact that you have a United Nations, literally and figuratively, is all a consequence of this story. Until then, it was all, you know, if not one nation at least, but it seems like one language, one unity, you know, a sense of unified purpose. And something happens, and God gets very, very upset. And that would basically be my subtitle for the series. What exactly was their intention, and why was Hashem so mad? Neither of those, I posit, and I suggest to you, neither of those are at all clear from the text. So what I'd like to do, and I was just mentioning it to my mom on the way over here, I imagine that this will be at least a 3, if not a 4-part series. And we'll begin it this evening. And in fact, with all due apologies to my mother, who I don't believe will be here next week, but you are invited. You're always invited. There's an open door. Mother, I didn't say mother-in-law. I said mother. Yeah, I'm just kidding. My mother-in-law is also invited. But all of you especially will have the opportunity to be here next week. The truth is that we'll really get into the action of the story more starting next week. But the groundwork is laid in the psukim that we'll focus on this week, which are the first 3 psukim. Let's read as our typical style, so we get an overview, a sense of the whole story. Let's read the whole story, and then we'll go back and use the remaining time of the shiur to really analyze in depth the opening psukim. Now, I don't want to scare you. Reading the whole story won't take us that long. It's only 9 psukim. So you have this jam-packed, consequential story in 9 psukim, and then we'll go back, and I want to focus this evening on the first 3 psukim. So Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, again, you'll recall that at the end of the Perek of Tes, was after the aftermath of the flood, Noah and his daughters and that whole, and his sons and all that, his sons and all that story. Last week was Perek Yud, was the list of the genealogy of all of his children and his grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And now that sets the stage, again, after being told about the world being populated by Noah and his children, of course the only survivors of the flood, we are then told the following. Vayehi kol ha'aretz safachas. The whole world spoke one language. Udvarim achadim. How do you want to translate that? That you're cheating, and I know it. How do I know you're cheating? Because that is certainly not the literal translation of the pasuk. Now, my guess is that is how the article translates it. Am I right? You can admit it. We're among friends. So your reason that the article translates it that way is we're going to see that that's something that Rashi suggests. And as we have seen throughout our years learning together, whenever Rashi takes something off of the literal meaning, more often than not, our scroll makes an editorial decision to translate it based on Rashi. So you're not wrong. But let's take a step back and pretend that we didn't have our scroll or Rashi. I'm not sure what would be a bigger tragedy, but without our scroll or Rashi, how would you translate the words Udvarim Achadim? And I'm going to ask you really the easier of the two. The word Dvarim, what does that mean?
Words.
Achadim from the language of Achaz, singular or unified. Now, if that is the literal understanding of the Pasuk, what's the obvious problem? What's the obvious problem?
It's redundant.
It's redundant. We just said Safa Achat, one language, unified or single words. Okay, so good. So the simple translation of the Pasuk is as we demonstrated, but it raises a problem. You can imagine why, whether it's Rashi or others, are then going to be translating it like Marvin. Once you've forced the problem, we'll have to see then what the resolution is. But the simple understanding is that the Pasuk is just telling us simply that the whole world was of one tongue. Now, by the way, does the Torah tell us what language that was? Okay, so we'll have to see a discussion of that as well. Pasuk Beis. Vayihi binas am mikedem. And it came to pass when they, who's the they? Presumably, unless we hear otherwise, it's not really important who, or maybe it means everyone, those people who've just spoken about, when they migrated, when they moved mikedem from the east, v'yimtzu bika be'eretz shinar, they found a valley, a plains, a flatter area, a low area, in the area of the world known as Shinar, v'yishvu sham. Va yishvu sham. Yes. And they settled there. So this migrating people, the descendants of Noah, and by the way, Noah was old, but he was still alive. And by the way, according to Chazal, if you do the math of Chazal, Avraham was young, but Avraham was already alive. And Shem may have even been alive. So you had some heroes, and the Radak, I didn't put it on the sheet, the Radak actually goes out of his way to say that there were some spiritual heroes who presumably did not participate in this. But the majority of people who are not being singled out, it doesn't seem to be that important, frankly, at least at this point, who we're talking about, the masses traveled. Pasuk Gimel. Vayomru ish el reyehu. And again, this idea of, you know, so often there's a certain star or star power that move a story, you know, Noah and his story or others. Sometimes you don't have a mention of a personality, and that itself is the story. It's every man. There is a star to the story, but the star is everyone. And it seems like the Torah is almost, at least at this point, it would seem to me, on the simple understanding, going out of its way to suggest that what we're about to hear was so common and so ubiquitous, it didn't matter. It was the rabbi, it was the Navi, it was the priest, it was the gardener, it was the Indian chief, who cares what it was? Everyone was talking. People were talking to each other. Hava nilvana, let us make levanim, let us make bricks, the nisrafa lesrefa, and let us burn them in fire, v'tehila hem halevena le'evin, and that will turn the bricks into stone, v'chemer hayilahem lechomer. And it's not clear, a big discussion, what exactly this material is, but some of that will also be hardened and turned into a building material into some form of plaster. That's a very peculiar kind of a pasuk. You know what I mean? Like, you know, this is, I got two left hands. I don't just say that because I'm a lefty. Meaning, I wouldn't know what a hammer and a nail, but that's part of the reason I went into the rabbinate. It was safe for me. You know what I mean? Like, this is not a home improvement. This is not build the house or dream house or any of these things, you know, or one of the big stores, Lowe's. You know, like, when does the Torah start telling us, you know, how they made the bricks and, you know, like, what? Why does that matter? So let's keep that in mind. I think that's a reasonable question as well. And what did they do with all these bricks now that everyone had this great plan, let's build bricks? Vayomru. And they said, Hava nivne lanu ir umigdal. Let us build a great city with a tower, Verosho, and the top of that tower, Bashamayim, will go all the way up to the heavens. Nasa lanu shame, and we'll be famous. We'll make a name for ourselves. Pen nafutz al pnei aretz. And here you have almost a pivot. Not some proactive positive, let's make a name, but something more to avoid. What's the problem? We don't want to become dispersed across the world. Now, are these two reasons or one? And what was the fear? Why would they have worried that if they didn't build a tower, they would have been dispersed? Not clear. And if they build a tower, how does that help? none of this is, of course, clear. This is raising lots and lots of questions. Pasuk A. Vayered Hashem. So now, that's like the end of stage two. I should have told you this at the beginning. As far as if I was the director of this show, act one is the first three psukim, which are really just introductions, but nothing nefarious. We don't know anything that would trick, because for all we know, they're building the Beit HaMikdash. They're building a Beit HaMikdash. We know about that as the people, they move, they spoke a language, and they wanted to build bricks. Three and four are kind of a transition. To me, I would break it up and just put four, Pasuk Dalet as a separate Pasuk, only because here's the first time that we get a little motivation, and even though we don't know any details yet, we don't understand anything yet. But already you could see why maybe this isn't such a great idea, you know, just do things who are famous. I mean, it's an ego trip, you know, a little bit of a transition. And, but, you know, so I would call maybe this is either the end of Act 1, if you will, or even if it's own act itself. But certainly the next stage of the story clearly begins in Pasuk Hei. And that is after having observed what's going on down below, we have the emergence of a new character, and his name is God. Pasuk Hei. Vayered Hashem liros ha'sa'ir ve'es ha'migdal. And again, I want to point out, as we just saw previously, although I didn't really stress then, there's a double language here. What is that? The city and the tower. Anyone hear of the city of Babel? It's the tower of Babel. You know, we all know that. So what's this ear? Not clear yet. Correct. We didn't get to that either. That's right. I'm doing what I always tell you not to do, which is that I'm bringing in a lifetime of knowledge in. That lifetime is baggage and confusing. So let's move that. So just for lack of a better term, for laziness and convenience, I've been using that term. But Barry, your point is well taken. I will cease and desist. What? Gotham. Where'd you get that name? Is there a superhero? Okay.
Why does it have the word S there? Because the first time it says here,
I don't know.
Without the S.
I don't know.
When God's looking at it, I would think the S words are there to say.
It's a good point. I don't know.
He really is a very distinct entity from the tower.
So. Yes, the extra S definitely divides them. Good. So that's, again, not so we're. Our focus today is going to be the first three psukim. We're not going to get back to that, but perhaps next week we'll have an answer. But that's a good suggestion and a good point. So God comes down, if you will. Obviously, that means that's not a literal phrase, but as it were, God descends, and he sees the city and the Migdal and the tower, Asher Banu Bnei Adam, that the people built. Vayomer Hashem, and God says, Hein Am Echad, behold, one people, Vasafa Achas L'Kulam, they all have one language. Is that a newsflash to God? He didn't know this yet. It's an epiphany. Yeah. V'zeh hachilam la'asos. And this they begin to do. Now, I can't translate this without making an assumption about how to translate it. But truth be told, as we will see, there's a big machlokes how to translate whether what I just said was accurate. Is it really, was it meant to be rhetorical? And this they want to do? Or was it what's called lashon bitmiyah? Or was it more nice and straightforward, what they call benichusa, and this they plan to do. What the difference between those two are, for a future week, for a future shiur. Va'ata, and now Hashem says, Lo yivatzer mehen, kol asher yazmu la'asos, should it not be withheld from them, all that they propose, all that they plan to do. Again, I'm reading that as rhetorical, we'll have to see if that's really accurate in a future shiur. So, assuming that we're reading it more or less correctly, God seems to be disturbed, although what is completely absent, at least so far? Why is he disturbed? Did they do something wrong? Don't know. Hava ner de pasuk zayin, Hashem says, and again in a plural, which is of course striking, in a plural, let us go down, v'nov l'sham sfasam, and let's confuse their language. When a person won't be able to understand his friend or his neighbor's language. Now, clearly here, the implication is that there's a punishment. But what did they do wrong? Not at all clear. And typically we assume God punishes midah keneged midah, that the punishment fits the crime. So what about whatever they did wrong is going to be impacted by this choice of punishment. Pasuk Ches. Vayafet Hashem Osam Misham, God dispersed them from there, apnei kol aretz. What's the irony of that, that he dispersed them throughout the world? The whole purpose, or one of the purposes of building it, was that they should stay unified. And that, in the end, it's moot. Okay, well, we still don't know what's... What's so bad about being unified? I seem to have heard that there's a shul in Baltimore that talks about that a lot. I think it's on Greenspring. Achdus, Epis. Whoever heard that Achdus is a bad thing? Is that really the crime? I don't know. And as a result, of course, in the ultimate, if you will, put the brakes, not only were they dispersed, but the dispersion happened... He created a premature ending of their building. V'yachdolu livnos ir, and they had to stop building the city. And now, Barry, Alkein Karshma Bavel. And now it's called Bavel, because what is the word Bavel? What's the etymology? Kisham Balal Hashem Safas Kalarts. God confused, mixed up all the languages of the world. Umishaman, from there he feeds them Hashem up in the color. It's God dispersed them. That's the end of the story. Pasuk Yud. Boring. Ela told those shame. These are the children of shame. Story's over. It like ends very starkly. Fade out. Black. Curtain closed. 9 psukim. One of the most consequential stories in the human history. Which I think, as we demonstrated, reading the psukim raises a lot more questions than it answers, at least on the surface. So it'll be our job to hopefully continue to ask the good questions, and now to start providing some answers. Before we see anything like Rashi or commentary on the Psukim, I want to show you a little bit of a comment by the Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim, in the Guide to the Perplexed. This is, of course, the Rambam's famous work of philosophy. And the Malbim in our Perek has a similar comment, but I didn't have time to put it on the sheet, and it's a long Malbim, and the Malbim makes a lot of points which may be relevant to future Shiurim, so we'll get to the Malbim, I promise. But for the purpose of tonight, you know what I just realized? Look what I did. When I was preparing the Shiur, look at the second thing right after the Rambam. I've never done this in almost 4 years of giving the Shiur. I put down the Malbim on the sheet, hoping I'd have time to get back to it. But I never got back to it. So you see, my heart was in the right place. Anyway, there is a Malbim, but we don't have it on the sheet. The Rambam, in essence, and I think the Malbim more or less agrees, he just adds some color and contour and some emphasis, but the Rambam, in essence, is asking a question. Why is this story here? What do we need to know this for? What's the consequence of this story? Now, you'll recall, we asked that kind of a question last week. I mean, the Rishonim. What was the purpose of Perek Yud? This guy had how many kids, and these were his names, and how many kids. What was the point of all that? And we saw, interestingly, the answer was so we would know the yichus of Avram. Right? We needed to know Avram, therefore we had to know about shame. And we're going to know that Avram takes over a land called Canaan. Well, who's Canaan? Where did Canaan come from? So we had to learn about Chum. And then, once we're saying 2 out of 3 kids, not fair to poor Yefet, so we threw him in there also. But it's a reasonable question. The Rishonim asked the question last parak. So here the story's a little bit more exciting, a little bit more spicy. You could lose sight of that, but it's still a question. It's like a bracket in history. Like, we need to know about Bereishis, okay, that's pretty somewhat obvious. And Noah was God's, take two at the world. Okay, Bereishis didn't work with Adam and Chava. Let me try with Noah. That's not going to work. We have a flood. So we could understand if it skipped to Avram. Right? That's take three. And it's obviously the most consequential because that's the one that worked and that's the one that we come from. But this is like this PS, this bracketed story. And I can almost even better understand the next Perek, or the rest of this Perek, which again continues what I'll call the bookkeeping of the family and the lineage. Like, okay, if that's important, we have to keep good records, so we need to know. But here is a story. You think there was no other soap operas in the time of Noah? You think there was no other interesting things that people tried to do? Probably someone tried to come up with a football, someone invented it, people tried lots of things. We don't need to know about them. Why are we told this? What's important about this story? Well, we assume that, especially because Hashem seems to be upset at them, although the Torah never says that, and we still don't even know what the rebellion is. But why is that important? Is this the only people that rebelled? Maybe. Okay, I guess that's one possibility. This is, you know... So they should have known. Or at least their grandparents did.
They
yeah. Okay. So what's... Okay, I like that. That's an interesting idea. I didn't think about that. And what would be a good take-home message from that? That's interesting. Very interesting. Very interesting. Although I like how human it is. The only problem with that is that the Torah ascribes motive to them, and this is not one of them. So maybe that's why. Okay, good. That's not bad. Not bad. Not bad. That's very interesting. Very interesting. The other message I would say to you, by the way, Marvin, is that it shows you the constancy of human nature. It doesn't matter how many times you got punished, how many times you survived. People who are tempted, they don't care. I remember, I recall actually, I don't know if my parents came with me, but years ago after they first moved to Florida, I was visiting them, and on a Motzei Shabbos, Alana and I went to their shul. Rabbi Yochanan's wife was giving a shir in Beth Israel, in their shul. And I don't remember everything that he said, but one of the things that I remember, his wife, as some of you may know, is a lawyer. He went to law school. So he pulled out of his law school back pocket, he mentioned that in whatever period of history, England was famous for their public hangings. And one of the things that they used to, one of the crimes that would get hanging was pickpocketing. They were a pretty tough crowd in those days. But why did they make a public hanging? As a deterrent. I don't know how they figured this out, but he quoted something that sounded authoritative, that they observed, in retrospect, that there were a humongous number of pickpockets which occurred at the hangings. Imagine everywhere, crowds of people, everyone's looking. So here you have, so what else do you know about human nature? You have to hang the guy for pickpocketing, but I'm going to get away with it. What do you got in the pocket there, Harry? Harry, it's just a dirty tissue. That will deter me from trying again, I can tell you that. Yeah, more exactly. It's got to be worth something. Anyway.
Clean handkerchief.
Okay, fine, Harry. Harry, your dirty handkerchiefs are fine. We're close. Also, anyway, okay. So the Rambam addresses this question, and he gives an interesting answer. And he puts it as part of a larger motif. We're not going to read all of it inside, but I have it here for you if you want to read it. And he basically says as follows. This is in a chapter where he asks the question, in essence, what's the purpose of all of these seemingly irrelevant stories? Not just this one. This is just an example. He goes through many of them. What is the purpose of these stories in Tanakh? And he mentions, if you take a look on the third line, Da, you should know, Ki kol sipur shetim se'ehu kosuv batorah, any story you find in the Torah, Hula to'elis, Hechrachit b'Torah. There is some absolute... What? Right, it's every story is absolutely necessary. Some, im l'emes da'as, in order to know certain truisms, or he says, next phrase, l'tikun ma'asem min ha'masim, it has ethical implications, it'll make you a better person. Ashlo yebein b'nei adam avel v'chamas, you could learn to be a nice person, not to steal from people, beat people up. And he says, he continues, and I'll tell you the following. He says, what is the purpose of this story? I'll explain to you what's going on with this story. The world was created anew from nothing. And there was Ish Echad Mimin Adam, who Adam Arishon, and God made one single human being, Adam. So if the world, if the human population began with one person, Noah, Adam, excuse me, approximately 2,500 years from the birth of Adam till Moshe Rabbeinu. So 2,500 years on the one hand seems like a lot of time, sure, a lot of time to me, but in the history of the world, not necessarily a huge amount of time. And more importantly, says the Rambam, I mean, considering how different the world was, a very short amount of time. After all, he says, for Ilu Balahem, now I'm reading the underlying part, for Ilu Balahem ze hasipur levad, if you just knew this story, Haya Adam Mesupak Badavar, if you just knew, we had Adam, we had Moshe, a person could doubt the truth of the Torah. Kinim su'u az b'nei Adam ufuzarim. People, by the time anyone's reading this story, the Torah, people are completely dispersed. Ktavos aretz in all four corners of the world. Kula, the whole world. Umishpachos chalukos. Families live in different parts of the world. Not just strangers, families. Ulashonos chalukim rechokim od, in such radically different languages and dialects. But who, and in essence, he's implying a question. How could it be? How do you go, right? What's, this is the opposite of e plubris unum, right? Not out of many, one. Out of one, many. How do you go from one family, presumably they live close together, whatever Noah Adam spoke, which we don't know yet, but which we're going to get to actually, he spoke to each other, you know, and then in a relatively short period of time, wherever they lived, it was one place. Now they're covering thousands and thousands of miles of geography, completely dispersed, countless languages, countless times, 1,000 dialects of all the languages. How is it possible? Give me a break. How is it possible that this is the true story? That one led to so many? Eventually, over time, it would disperse and diffuse a little bit. But the Rambam assumes that the numbers wouldn't add up. To go from one to that many in such a short period of time, he said it would be impossible. And therefore, he says, V'husar ha-safek b'yachsam kulam v'zikron hista'afam. And now, in order to remove this question, this doubt, we're going to get this information, this story. And it mentions these names, whether it's the famous people or other people who aren't so famous, their names, how long they lived, where they lived, why, v'hatam, end of the third to last line, ha-mevi li-hit-pazram, v'katzos, kitzos, ha-aretz. We now, with this story, we now learn how it is that they came to be so dispersed. V'atam ha-mevi la-chelek, or la-chilok, l'shenosam, why they have such different languages. You're right. One family, and forget Adam. Even if you say take two, the descendants of Noach, mamish, one little family. No matter how fertile they were, so they grew. But how big could they have gotten? And how disparate? And what, they didn't have like a reunion every now and then? Like they didn't even know how to talk to each other? How did that happen? Rather, Anachanami, so now the Torah tells us, you're right, that's not like a heretical or cynical question. That would have made sense. Al pi derech hateva. Whatever the laws, and I'm not even sure what science or what field would study such a thing.
Anthropology.
Okay, so good. So whatever the, good, I accept that. Whatever the standard, that's a standard anthropological question a person could have. And if you just use the usual model, so to speak, of projection of anthropology, you would never have come up with what came out in such a short period of time. As we know, scientists don't think it was a short period of time. But even if you just take the 2,500 years between Adam and Moshe, it doesn't make any sense. After all, it should have been much smaller. So says Rambam, you're right. That's exactly what it was. Ki kein roi liyosam b'nei ish echad. That's what makes sense. When people are, in essence, descending from one person, whether this one person is Noah, this one person is Adam, there wasn't one person. So the Rambam, again, interesting, man of religion and science, tells us, you could have had a legitimate beef, you could have had a legitimate question. How is it possible that the Torah says that God created Adam first, and now, from that one guy, we got all this mess? So he says, that's what the Torah wanted to tell you. You're right. Naturally, there was a certain, until Perek Yud Aleph, there was a certain diffusion and a certain growth and a certain spreading out. But it never would have gotten this much. They were still small enough in that generation that we could talk about them moving east, them speaking a language, them having a common purpose, Marvin. We could speak about such things. And it would have eventually gotten more and more diffuse, but much slower. There was an accelerant that was added to the process, and that is known as this divine intervention in the aftermath. So you wonder, what's the purpose of the story? I don't know, I would ever would have guessed this. But the Rambam says the purpose of the story is Kirov, Amuna, Hashkafa. You should know that the idea that there's so many different people, different languages, different races, etc., Shkinakasha. Yeah, that it wouldn't have made sense, except for if you know the fact that there was this story. The Malbim says something similar, but at this point you'll have to trust me. Going further now. The whole world spoke one language. What language? I have a shock for you. It wasn't Yiddish. How do I know that? Don't shoot me, I'm not a heretic. Don't shoot me. How do I know that? Look at Rashi. Safa Achas, Lashon HaKodesh. Now, of course, depending on who you ask, Yiddish might be the Lashon HaKodesh. But I don't think that there was Yiddish in the time of Rashi. Yeah. But it's not Kodesh, or at least not the way Rashi means it. Lashon HaKodesh. Now, whether modern Hebrew is Lashon HaKodesh is a separate question. Because that's clearly not a biblical language either. That's also been not only corrupted, but also adapted. So what the halachic status of modern Hebrew is actually an interesting shaila. I actually spoke about it, if you want. There's audio of that shir I gave 5 years ago, Parshas Noach, on a Thursday night. The Thursday night Cholent shir was on the status of modern Hebrew, and there's a big discussion about that. But whatever Lashon HaKodesh is, let's call it biblical Hebrew, says the Rashi, this is what was being referred to, this is what everyone spoke. Not just the tzaddikim, not just Shem and our ancestors, but everybody. Chum and Yafes, Canaan, the whole gang. Rashi is, we're going to get to that. Don't steal my thunder, Harry. So, take a look at your sheet. The Radak says this as well. And it's striking because, as you know, Radak and Rashi will often disagree in what methodologically speaking, Rashi is much more willing to accept Medrash. Radak is, not blindly, but much more oriented towards Pshat. You might have thought this is kind of a drush. I mean, how would anyone know that it's Lashon HaKodesh? Rashi's quoting a Medrash. But Radak wouldn't typically do that. The Radak says, no, Pasha Pshat. This is what it was. It was Lashon HaKodesh. Kolomar says Radak, Lashon Echad Medabri Kulum. Everyone spoke the same language. Hu Lashon HaKodesh, Kamo Shekasavnu. So he adds, it was Lashon HaKodesh, like we have said. Who's we? We means the Radak. But when did he say that? Go all the way back to Perek Beis Pasuk Chaf. So I took a look. What does the Radak say all the way back on Perek Beis Pasuk Chaf? Who remembers what the world was going on in Perek Beis Pasuk Chaf? We learned it together. Undying affection for those who get it without cheating. Who remembers? Okay, even if you don't remember, look it up. What's going on in Perek Beis Pasuk Chaf? It's a very consequential pasuk, especially for a few people in the room. And the end of the pasuk. The end. Chava. Hey, Chava is in the picture now. Chava is created. Chava, right? So take a look. The animals are created, and Adam is lonely. Because after all the animals have a mate, and Adam doesn't have a mate, and Adam gives names to all the animals. So what did he call them? When he saw a big gray thing with a really, really long nose, what did he call it? Did he call it an elephant? I don't think so. Did he know English? I don't know. Who knows? Give me another language for elephant.
Pew.
That's the Hebrew one, not that one. give me a different language. Anyone know? Give me another language that somebody here knows for another animal. Japanese, Chinese.
Cat. Spanish.
And say again?
Perro.
Arrow?
Perro
is a dog. Perro?
P-R-O-O
is a dog. Perro. Okay, so he saw a thing going, and Adam named it. The pasuk tells us. What did he call it? Did he call it a dog? I don't think, unless he knew English. Did he call it a perro? Not unless he knew Spanish. So what did he call it? Mm-hmm. He called it a kelev. Says the Radak. Take a look. Hashemo Shakara Adam, these names that Adam gave to all the animals. The Lashon HaKodesh Kara Osam. He called them in Lashon HaKodesh. Ki HaLashon HaZeh HaYadiburo. Because that was his vernacular. That's what he spoke to Chava. That's what he spoke to the kids. V'chein Dibur Kol Adam Ad Dor HaFlaga. Says Radak back then. I don't know about you, but I didn't notice this 2 years ago when we were learning Bereishis Perek Beis. He forecasts, foreshadows, I should say, our story. Says it wasn't just that Adam spoke it, the whole world spoke it. Until the generation of the Haflaga, of the dispersement, when people got separated. So this is, the Radak is consistent, is L'shitaso, that from the beginning of human history, they spoke Lashon HaKodesh. Take a look at the next sources, the Mizrahi. The Mizrahi we've seen quite a few times in our studies together. The Mizrahi is what we call a supra-commentary. Namely, the Mizrahi is not a commentary on the Chumash. The Mizrahi is a commentary on a commentary, a supra-commentary. A commentary on who? On Rashi. Mizrahi is one of the earliest commentaries on Rashi. That's how consequential Rashi was even hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Mizrahi was a Rishon, I think. It's not an early Achram. I think he was a Rishon. So he wrote a commentary on Rashi. So he explains, where did Rashi pull this out of? Like, why would you say that it's Lashon HaKodesh? So Mizrahi says, from a pasuk, three psukim later, the Radak makes his point about naming the animals. Three psukim later, says Mizrahi, mashma mikra, the pasuk says that Adam was that Chava was referred to, at least at this point in the story, as Isha. Why was she called Isha? Lizos yikara Isha, kimi ish lukachazos. She comes from Adam's rib. So Isha is a conjugated form. It implies that she comes from the Ish. Adam is the Ish. Isha comes from the Ish. That's the pasuk. Now, what's that proof? Says the Mizrahi. Ein shem ha'isha nigzar b'shem ha'ish b'shum lashon chutz mi lashon ha'kodesh. Now, I can't tell you that that's necessarily true or not, but I dare anyone to tell me that he's wrong. Says the Mizrahi, you will not find...
Huh?
Well, that he lived before English. That's also true. Right, but that's, well, there was no English then, I guess. Well, actually, it might have been old English. I don't know what they called their own English. But says Radak, Mizrahi, and I guess, well, let's put it this way, it's really in those times. Well, I guess, no, that's tautological. I take that back. Anyway, so he says, what's my proof? Because what other language do you have where you could, in such a small variation, basically have the same word for man and woman, for female and male, I guess. He adds, V'chein Perish Rashi, he quotes our Pasuk, and then he says, on that Pasuk, back in Bereishis, Rashi says, also accepts this, and then he goes further, not just, as Harry alluded to, not just that this was always the spoken language of the beginning of humanity, but more than that, Mikan Shenivra Ha'olam B'Lashon HaKodesh. Even before there was mankind, the world was created with Lashon HaKodesh. And once you know it goes all the way back to Adam, if not before even him, and we know that the world, since the Torah tells us, only spoke one language, so they were speaking that language there, that's one. There was no change until our story, that's plus one. Equals two, it must be that until then, the one language that everyone spoke wasn't just the people like Adam and Noah who were close to God. Everybody! Even the Chalarias in the generation of the flood, when they went to rape, burn, and pillage, Acharai, they said it in Hebrew, follow me, let's go do it. Everyone, that was the spoken language. Yechuyav, he says, it must be, Shetiyah HaSafa Hahi Lashon HaKodesh Bechrech, without any doubt, he says, this is not just, you know, from points, without any doubt, he says, it must be, empirically, he claims, to demonstrate that it was Lashon HaKodesh. Now, what is interesting is that a completely different take on the whole pasuk of one language, Safa Achat, is cited in a debate in the Talmud Yerushalmi. One opinion in the Talmud Yerushalmi, here on the bottom of the page, look at the second underline, refers to Lashon HaKodesh as just striking the description that's used, V'Lashon Yechido Shel Olam. The language of God, God's language. So we started off with Noach, Adam, and it's even earlier than that. It's God's language, Lashon HaKodesh. That's one opinion, and that's consistent with everything we've seen. But the first explanation explanation of the Yerushalmi is really mind-blowingly fascinating, and as far as I know, no one teaches this, and not many people, myself included, before preparing for this year, even know of it. Says the Gemara in one opinion, completely different. Shehoyu medabrim b'shivim loshon. Not true at all. They had 70 languages, and whether that means literally or figuratively, 70 languages back then, not one language. But the Torah says it's one language. What does it mean? It means, take a look, doesn't explain. What do you mean? The Torah says it's one language, and this opinion says no, 70 language. So you have to take a look at the commentaries on the Yerushalmi. Take a look. There's two classical commentaries on the side of the Yerushalmi. One is called the Karban Ha'eda, the other is called the Pnei Moshe. Says the Karban Ha'eda, what is the Yerushalmi getting at? Shehoya kol echad mevin sfas chavero, af al pisha divreim hayu miyuchadim. They all spoke various different languages. The Chinaman spoke Chinese, and the American spoke English, and the Spaniard spoke Spanish. But everyone was fluent in all 70 languages. So I'm a Chinaman, and you're a Spaniard, and I speak to you in Chinese, and you understand me, and speak and reply in Spanish, and I understand you. There was one language in the sense that everyone could communicate. What is the implication of one? It was unified. There were no barriers between people. People could communicate without the need for translators or they didn't need it. They could speak directly to each other. The world was unified.
You have something very close to that.
Why? What is there? Everyone understands it.
And everyone else really does understand enough of the language.
Now that's millions of people, four languages, and it's unbelievably fascinating. And it's only a fraction of what the Yerushalmi is describing of all the people in the world and 70 languages, right? It's an astounding thing. But according to this opinion, that's what the Yerushalmi holds. Just P.S., the second opinion, which wasn't anything new for us, that we're talking about Lashon HaKodesh, which is interesting, the Karban Ha'eda, when he's looking to date or to identify what's the significance of Lashon HaKodesh, he refers to that as the language that the Torah was given in. Medaber HaKodesh Baruch Hu B'yom Shenasan HaTorah. I don't mean that the Chumash is in Hebrew, we know that. But when God spoke to the Jewish people from the mountain, what language did he speak in? He spoke in Lashon HaKodesh. Turn over. That's the first opinion of the Yerushalmi. And the Pnei Moshe agrees. Take a look and turn over your page. Pnei Moshe, he just, we'll read it just for the sake of clarity, but he says in essence the same thing. That's right. There could be spies. B'shivim, I thought you were not allowed to tell us about your profession.
I'm not.
Okay. I don't want you to get in trouble. I don't want you to lose your pension or anything like that. He was a spy, for those of you who don't know. He disappeared for a few years during the 70s. I'm not joking. This is an American hero. B'shivim lashon shahayu mikodem hamabul. That's a typo, excuse me, that should be a vav. The limdu mi Noach ubanav. Where'd they know all the languages from? Had they know all 70 languages? Noach and family were conversant, and they didn't just teach each other their own language, they taught each other the 69 other languages. And therefore, everyone knew all 70. B'zeh safachas. That's what it means to say b'safachas. That's what the Torah meant when it said one language. Shayukulam yodim b'chaloshim revidim zeh. They all understood each other itself. And just getting back to, and what does it mean, Lashon HaKodesh? So here, the Pnei Moshe, he chooses to date it, the earliest possible date, Hu Lashon HaKodesh Shebo Nivra Olam. The world was created.
So, Rambam was making the point of how unusual it would be over 2,500 years to be dispersed in different languages, and they're claiming that these languages predated everything. How would that come about?
It's totally different. There's a total disagreement.
But, so...
You're saying, how did... Oh, I don't know. The Yerushalmi does not address that at all. It doesn't address it. I don't know. We have to speak to the anthropologist. Is it really, was the Rambam's point really true that it wouldn't have computed? I don't know. The Yerushalmi does not address that. It's a good observation. I don't know what they would say.
Mizrahi could have quoted the other statement because it actually, where it says specifically, where Adam called her Chava, ki hi al Yisraelim called Chai. Chava and Chai.
Okay.
Well, I mean,
I got you. Good.
Quite
okay.
Specific there.
Good. Interesting.
Really said that autumn cold.
Right. Okay. We have less than 10 minutes left, and I want to cover just the rest of the sheet. So it's interesting that right after saying Lashon Achas, Safa Achas, then it said Dvarim Achadim, and we all agree.
Achadim can mean unique things, unique words. I mean, that's how I read it the second time.
But what, so what does that mean? What would the phrase mean then? One language, unique things. What does that mean? How do you make sense of that?
Everybody understands that.
Again, we're talking about human interaction. They spoke. How did they speak? In one language or 70, according to what you're saying?
That there was a commonality. There was Safa Echad, that they really understood each other, with Barim Achadim, comprised of all these little pieces that were all unique.
What does that mean, pieces?
What does that mean?
Vague. I mean, I'm not blaming it. The pasuk is vague.
It could lay support to the
shem. That's what I'm trying to get at. That's what she means. That's what I'm trying to get at.
No, that there was a real understanding that, you know, like elu to elu, you understand it this way, but you also accept that this.
So when two people spoke,
there's a commonality there that transcends language. That there was a bond.
Okay. Okay. Well,
Harry.
I gotta go. I'm sorry, Harry. So let's see what the various mafarshim say. Take a look at Rashi. Dvarim achadim. So Rashi quotes what Marvin miraculously knew 50 minutes ago. Rashi quotes the art scroll. Rashi quotes a different approach, not the literal translation. Rashi says, Dvarim achadim bo'u be'etza achas. They had a course of action. Common purpose, I think, was what Marvin said. A common purpose and a common goal. And what was that common goal? A nefarious one. Amru, and they said, Lo kol heimenu. It's not right. Who gave God the right? Sheyavur lo efa elyonim. That he keeps up the heavens for himself? Why? Na'alel rakia. We're going to go up to the heavens. And we'll do battle. We'll see you at high noon. So, two things to make the point. Number one is, you see, Rashi is giving you a non-literal translation of this phrase. Why? I think, as we said at the outset of this year, because literally, it seems to be redundant. So, he's forced to give a different explanation. Secondly, something we'll have to get back to in future shurim, Rashi is already telegraphing what he thinks the problem was. As we said, there's no indication from the pasuk about anything like this, or any of the nine pasukim. Clearly, he's describing a form of Avodah Zarah. Let's take on God. A denial of God in some form. We didn't get that from the Pesukim, did you? So, where Rashi got this from, what are the implications, who else agrees with him, etc., etc., we'll see that in future Shurim. But I want to add one thing already now, and we'll see this, I hope, in the next few sources as well, a struggle. Even though we're at the opening of this chapter, it's the most innocuous kind of background information possible, you see from Rashi and others who are already trying to pull in foreshadowing of the mussar of the story, of the message of the story. To what extent can we almost even, can we talk about them? You know, it's like, can you talk about, I'll give you this is maybe sound like a left field example, but bear with me. Could somebody from our generation speak about the Germans in World War II dispassionately? Or could we get it out of our mouth without the word Yimach Shemo? So one person might be able to speak about, well, first they did this, and they had this ideas and these ideas, and then they took a wrong turn and they started doing all these terrible things. We'll get to the bad stuff. We're not going to hide it. We're not sugarcoating it. We're not denying it. But I can talk about what came first. First they, you know, wanted to make the trains run on time, and they wanted to do this, and all the social, you know, all the social democratic stuff that they were called, that they did, that was their original domestic platform. And others who already know how the story ends and are so colored and by that ending, even in the beginning, before they did anything bad, would already be talking about them with the Yimach Shemo. So Rashi is that one, and we'll see others who follow him. In other words, Rashi, even when he's talking about psukim, which aren't at all editorializing, and aren't all negative, Rashi's already bringing in that we see hinted at. In the early psukim, we can already see hints. Maybe we didn't know it at the time, but in retrospect, we can already see hints of those terrible, terrible things that they were going to do. Take a look at your sheet.
That's just one theory.
Yes. Yes, although the other ones are very, yes, but the other ones are also are very similar. Take a look at, let's take a look. Devar Acher. Al Yichudu Shel Olam. They were saying things against. No, no, not they were speaking in Lashon HaKodesh. Al Yichudu. No, no, it's not. It's on, or it's against. Not that they were speaking the language. It's not a reference to they were speaking Hebrew. It's they were going to speak against. It's not as specific as the first. Yes, yes. And the idea of Achadim is a play on words. Achadim is a play on Yichud Shel Olam, the one with the capital O. Not Obama, by the way.
That's what
the Yerushalmi was not speaking it as a pejorative, or the Yerushalmi was saying that they spoke the language of God.
Right.
Here it means that was on Safachat. That's the first part of the pasuk. The second part of the pasuk, this Pini Yerushalmi is talking about that they were already speaking against God. Take a look at Radak. Radak says in your sheet, Haskama Achas. They were of one mind. Again, what Marvin had said before, like Rashi, common purpose. Then the Radak adds something interesting. Because they were all of one language, it made it easier for them to have an agreement. And this is a fascinating truism to this very day. Right? Separate languages create barriers. When people speak a common language, they are much more likely to reach common conclusions, or for one to be able to persuade the next. So given the fact that they spoke a common language, therefore, again, so in the Pasuk, given the fact that they were Safa Achat, it's not surprising that they were Udvarim Achadim of common purpose. Fascinating way he puts together the phrases. And then he adds that Rashi's first pshat, or the whole gist of Rashi, Ubreishis Rabbah, which is what Rashi was quoting, L'shem Avodah Zarah Niskavnu, was a different approach. It's not a conflicting approach, but it's a different approach. Rashi and the Medrash rejected this Avodah Zarah idea. The Radak's not getting into that. We'll have to see. Maybe your Radak doesn't think there was any Avodah Zarah here. Maybe there was a different problem. But the way he breaks up the psukim is very fascinating. Take a look at the Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra gives a completely different dimension. What does that mean? Again, if we know they spoke the same language, so what is Devar Machadim? Isn't it redundant? Says Ibn Ezra, and for the sake of time, I'm going to read it outside. He said there was the following, again, I don't know if it's magical, but certainly untypical characteristic. In every language, he says, there are words, even though we all know English, but there might be one person who's very brilliant, who has a very articulate mastery of the language, and there's someone who's much more simple, and you could use all sorts of English words, and I know English, I'm an American. I don't know what you're talking about. It reminds me of, you know, people say, oh, did you hear of Aaron Lichtenstein in Hebrew? Oh, yeah, it's very hard in Hebrew. But I'm not sure I would understand him in English either. You know, he'll be using, you know, eight-syllable words and SAT words, you know, just because I know English and he's know English, same English. Says Ibn Ezra, that's common, that's typical. There's always somebody who knows the language so much better than you. Devar Machadim meant, for whatever, he doesn't explain how this phenomenon occurred, but he said that there wasn't that barrier. Again, there was no barrier to communication. Similar to what we saw before, whether it's the people understood languages that they didn't, different languages. In this sense, it's a similar upshot to the Yerushalmi. Either they had 70 different languages, but they all understood each other, no barrier. Or in this case, it was one language, but you didn't have the genius and the fool who couldn't talk to each other because one guy spoke slang and hick, and the other one spoke, you know, Ivy League. They all were able to speak to each other. Again, no barriers. It wasn't just one language, it was no barriers of language. The Medrash in your next source is the one that basically Rashi gives you only a slight parsing of. The first thing that Rashi tells us, the Medrash tells us is that in this generation, the first opinion of the Medrash is completely different. That Achadim is Aramaic, and it comes from an Aramaic word meaning hidden. Namely, as opposed to the story of the flood, where the Torah itself tells us what their crimes were, immorality and theft. Here, as we have made the point, we have no idea. We are going to have to try to figure out. We're going to have to put our Sherlock Holmes hat on and figure out, because clearly it was something. But the Torah never tells us it was hidden. That's the first opinion in the Medrash. The second opinion in the Medrash, second line, Achadim, he says, comes from the word hard. harsh. And he says they spoke harshly against God. Achad from the Lashon of one, but it's a reference, it's a poetic reference. Sh'amru dvarim chadim. They said harsh things. Al Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, on God, who's referred to as the One. And more shocking and more fascinating, even though he was at the early part of his career, says the Medrash, Avram was already making trouble. Meaning Avram was already trying to teach monotheism. And they didn't like that. They spoke harshly on Avraham, who's referred to by the Navi Yechezkel also as the One. Echad Haya Avram Ba'aretz. What did they say about Avram? This is really fascinating. I don't think this is well known. Amru Avraham, he's like a mule. He's barren. He won't be able to procreate. Now, some commentaries on the Medrash that I saw said, you think that Avram has the truth? We should all follow him and convert to his monotheism? If there's some God that he's really believing in and we all got it wrong, look how that God treats him. Instead of rewarding him for his virtue, he's punished. He can't have children. Remember, we know Avram had a long time till he could have children. He didn't have children yet. I think it means something different, and I won't have time to develop it, but I'll just tell you quickly. I think it may mean something else. And that is that they were basically making fun of him or telling each other, it's a flash in the pan. Every generation's got the new fads. So now there's some Meshuggah who's talking about this thing called monotheism. It has no kiyum, it has no legs. It'll be here today and gone tomorrow. Avram's not going to have any descendants. There's no one going to follow him. You're going to throw away your life and all the pleasures of this world for what he's selling. It's not going to be around. And it reminds me of something incredibly fascinating and controversial that I recently heard on an audio tape by Rav Nosson Kamenetsky. He's the brother of Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, lives in Eretz Yisrael, where he has a theory. He referred to certain Gedolim who never had any children, Nebuch, and he pointed out, and he used names, certain things that he considered to be very problematic or dangerous ideas or hashkafas that they had, and he attributed it to their lack of children. They were not invested enough in the future, and they got careless with things that they said, because when they left, there wasn't going to be anyone that they had to worry about. It wouldn't pick up pieces. I didn't say that. I'm not saying it's true. He says it. The audio is available for anyone who's interested. So, whether he's right or not. Yes. Worse. MP3. It's on the internet. Hey. Habitzar. Anyway. So, leave that aside. But I think there's a certain, whether it's true about a given person, that's not for me to say. But I think that might be shot in the Medrash. That's what they were ridiculing Avram. There's no point. There's no future in him. He can say whatever he wants now, because it's not going to affect anybody beyond him. And then the last thing that the Medrash says is that they made fun of God, and that was this idea of why should he be on top and us on bottom. Finally, last point to conclude this year. I'm sorry we're running a little late, but we started a little late. My apologies. The next took him. So they traveled eastward, and they said, let's make some bricks. Why do we care? What's the point? So if you take a look at Rashi, they traveled eastward, Mikedem, from the east. Rashi, again, and I would say consistent, as I said before, Rashi, at the beginning of the story, even when we're telling you innocuous details, Rashi is already looking to foreshadow and schlep in what we know as the end, the criticism. And Rashi says, Kedem here doesn't just mean east, it's an allusion to Kadmon, the prime force, to God. They moved away from the east, they moved away from the Kadmon, they were looking to abandon God. Now, in a million years, I wouldn't read the Pasuk and think that that's an allusion. Elamai, what's the point? Again, Rashi has it in his mind. It's like, you know, a survivor, a child of a survivor, talking about the German. You can't even talk about them in any rational way. It's only the Nazis, Yamach Shemom. Even when you talk about things that are not related to that. So too, Rashi can't see an allusion to these people without it being a hidden reference, at least, to their evil, to their wicked ways. I just want to contrast that significantly with the Sforno, who's on your sheet, and the Sforno says this is just very innocuous information. Just like other shepherds and other people in the world, they got to move to look different at grazing. You know, you have all your business in one part of the country, it's not doing well, so you diversify, you move to another part of the country, another part of the world. So they were moving, that's all, nothing. You know, again, you see, the Sforno is willing to wait till we get later to the story till we hammer them. Whereas Rashi can't wait. It's already there. And the last thing I want to mention is the bricks. What's the significance of the bricks, and why is the Torah telling us? So I saw an interesting quote in the Chama Leibowitz. She quotes the biblical scholar Ben O. Jacob, who points out something fascinating, which we will see further developed as she herself develops in future shiurim. And that is, you see here the incredible power of the human ingenuity. These were people, the Torah was telling us, they moved to an area that had no rocks. It was a soft valley, right? In the valley, everything slowed right from the rain, it just soft sediment. It wasn't a rocky hill. There was no natural material to make the bricks. How did they build this monstrosity? And the answer was, there was no precedent in human history at that time to do that. They invented, they created new methods of building. Were they able to take soft material and fire it like in a kiln and create hard building blocks? And this unbelievable ingenuity and the unlimited energy and power that is released by human creativity. And as a result, from all human history forward, from that point, it didn't matter where you lived. If you had the right education, you had the right tools, you could build a house, you could build a castle, you could build a fortress. You didn't need to be in a rocky area to get the rocks. And reminiscent, in a good way, right, used to be, well, if you lived in a desert, you couldn't plant. And then the people of Gush Katif came up with how to plant. They took the circumstances and they said, no, we're going to plant in the desert. Here, they built in the valley in a way that had been unprecedented in human history. And from that moment onward, that's now the property of who? The world. Now we have there, we all benefit from those things. What is left hanging by, in this quote from the Chaim Leibowitz, although she gets to it, I just didn't put on the sheet because we're not up to it yet, is, like everything, science is neutral. It can be used for good, it can be used for bad. And in the very next Pasuk Dalid, we see that they weren't just using it for good, something went wrong, and they use it for bad. And that is what we'll pick up with next week.